You're listening to a special edition of Around Noon as we talk about arts and culture during a break of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings on the nomination of John Roberts to the Supreme Court. I'm Dee Perry, and this is the show for Wednesday, September 14th. Jack Johnson became the first black man to win the country's heavyweight boxing championship in 1908. But the personality that drove him to victory was also the personality that led to his undoing. Johnson's story is chronicled in the Annisfield Wolf award-winning book, Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson. That book's author, Jeffrey C. Ward, will be honored tonight at the Annisfield Wolf Awards ceremony, and he joined me this morning in our IdeaStream studios. I asked Ward, what were the forces that turned Jack Johnson into the man that he became as a boxing champ?
Well, that's the great mystery of Jack Johnson's life. He's one of those people, I think, like Louis Armstrong or Thomas Edison or even Abraham Lincoln, that you can't account for. He was born into poverty at the worst possible time, the year after Reconstruction officially ended, in Galveston, Texas, and decided apparently from boyhood that he was going to be a great man, and as soon as he figured out he wanted to box, that he was going to be the heavyweight champion of the world. Mm. Why that was, is beyond me.
When he did become that, it would seem that he should have been a source of pride for the black community, but for many that wasn't the case. Why not?
Well, I don't like to generalize about communities because there were so many different views of him. He was, to most people, he was an enormous hero. He was the most celebrated black man in the world. He's probably the best known American of his time, probably more important, better known around the world than presidents were. But he had a colorful private life. And there were those people within the black community who took a dim view of that, and who thought he shouldn't behave that way for all sorts of reasons, from church people who simply didn't think people should live their lives that way to other people who thought he was somehow an embarrassment to the race. Mm-hmm. I don't think he ever saw himself as anything but himself. He didn't see himself as a representative of anybody. He just believed, I think he really believed in the Constitution. He really believed that if you had enough grit and determination, you ought to be able to succeed and nothing else should matter. And he lived his life that way.
Was that also his undoing, living his life that way in the early 20th century as a black man in America?
Sure. He went through ghastly trials, and the government finally set out to destroy him, and they did destroy him.
What was the vehicle?
The Mann Act. Which was they accused him of bringing a woman across state lines for immoral purposes. Now, he had probably done that a number of times in his life, but the one that they got him for, he wasn't doing that at all. He was helping an old lover out of a problem and gave her some money to come to Chicago.
How was your book intertwined with the Ken Burns documentary on Jack Johnson?
Well, I wrote the script for that. And that's how I got into, I've worked with Ken for a long time. I did jazz and baseball and Civil War and all those things. And this one, we were going to do a little skinny picture book about Jack Johnson because there are wonderful photographs. But the more I got into writing the script, the more I realized that there wasn't a sort of full-scale, or hadn't been for a long time, a full-scale biography of him, and that he richly deserved one. He is an extraordinary human being.
Would you share a few words from the book that can give just a slight flavor of Unforgivable Blackness?
Sure. I'll just read the two pages with which it begins, if that's all right.
Actually, two paragraphs would probably be closer to the time frame that we have.
Okay. The real Jack Johnson was both more and less than those who loved or those who hated him ever knew. He embodied American individualism in its purest form. Nothing, no law or custom, no person, white or black, male or female, could keep him for long from whatever he wanted. He was in the great American tradition of self-invented men, too, and no one admired his handiwork more than he did. All his life, whites and blacks alike would ask him, "Just who do you think you are?" The answer, of course, was always Jack Johnson. And that would prove to be more than enough for turn of the 20th century America to handle.
Those are the words of Jeffrey C. Ward, author of Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson. Jeffrey, how do you see Unforgivable Blackness expressing the ideals that the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards stand for?
Well, he is, first of all, it's a study in racism. I mean, I've been a historian, American historian, for about 40 years, and I thought I understood that the depth of racism at the turn of the 20th century. I had no idea of it until I got into reading about Jack Johnson. He was never presented as a human being by any white newspaper at any time. They made his perfectly coherent speech into Uncle Remus dialect. I fixed all that. I didn't change his grammar. I didn't change a word, but I spelled it the way he said it because we have recordings. We know what he sounded like. And I found, I just had no idea how deep that was, the language that was routinely used about him. And I think the story of his triumph over that fulfills the mission of this prize, really. He was an American. He wished to be treated as an American, and he made people treat him as an American as long as he could. He's an amazing person.
Thank you for sharing his story with us, Jeffrey. Such a pleasure to meet you, and congratulations on the award.
Thank you.
Jeffrey C. Ward is the author of Unforgivable Blackness, The Rise and Fall of Jack Johnson, and Ward is the winner of the Nonfiction Prize for this year's Annisfield Wolf Book Awards. He, along with A. Van Jordan, Edwidge Dantica, and Lifetime Achievement winner playwright August Wilson, will be honored tonight in a ceremony presented by the Cleveland Foundation at the Cleveland Playhouse's Drury Theater. That ceremony marks the Annisfield Wolf Awards' 70th anniversary. We'll bring you more of the award winners as you stay tuned to this special edition of Around Noon on 90.3. Nearly half the black population in America was out of work by 1932, courtesy of the Great Depression, and in some northern cities, whites called for blacks to be fired from any jobs as long as there were whites out of work. Racial violence became more common, and the number of lynchings, which had been declining, rose sharply in 1933. Surrounded by that sort of social climate, it's all the more noteworthy that a privileged white woman in mid-1930s Cleveland would create a legacy that not only promoted understanding between races, but rewarded it. That woman was poet and philanthropist Edith Annisfield Wolfe. In 1935, Wolfe launched a literary prize that recognized recent books, contributing to the understanding of racism and the appreciation of human diversity. This year marks the 70th anniversary of that prize, the Annisfield Wolf Book Awards. And tonight at the Cleveland Playhouse, the Cleveland Foundation will honor the 2005 winners of those awards. They joined us earlier this morning in our Around Noon studios. And today you are meeting some of those winners. We talked with Jeffrey C. Ward, author of Unforgivable Blackness. Also joining us was poet A. Van Jordan, a co-winner of this year's Annisfield Wolf Prize for Fiction, for his collection of poems titled Magnolia. In our conversation this morning, Van Jordan told me about the person who was at the center of that poetry collection, Magnolia Cox. Van, although your prize is for fiction, the person at the center of your poetry collection was a real person. Tell us a bit about who Magnolia Cox was.
Magnolia Cox was a precocious young girl in Akron, Ohio, during the 1930s, who was sort of a hero figure, it turns out, was called to represent her community and African Americans in a way that was sort of far beyond her means at that time, it seemed. But she rose to the occasion. She won the Akron District Spelling Bee, and then she went on to the Nationals and became the first African American to get into the final round of the National Spelling Bee. She was, as a result of that, by all reports, cheated out of the win by the Southern judges when they pulled a word that wasn't on the list. Ironically, the word was nemesis.
Yeah. You grew up in the Akron area?
Yes, I did.
Was that how you came across Magnolia's story?
No. Strangely, I had never heard of her while I was growing up there. And I was in Akron visiting family when I'd gotten up one morning and gone downstairs to my parents' kitchen, and there's the paper, and I opened the paper, and there's a column, This Place, This Time, which chronicled that date in history. And then there was her story. And I thought, wow, this is a really interesting story. So my folks are in their 70s, and I thought, oh, did you guys know this woman? Did you hear anything about this? They hadn't heard anything. And everyone I, you know, mentioned this to, no one had heard of her before. So I thought I'd follow it up. And I did a Google search, nothing. You know, and so I started trying to unearth as much as I could to find out who this woman was, because I thought I'd write just a sequence of poems within a book that dealt with the migration from the South to the North of
so
African Americans.
She was originally intended just to be a piece of a
just
larger
a piece
story.
Of a larger book. Mm-hmm. But then the more I looked at her story, it just distended into this larger and larger project, and I felt like she was emblematic of that time period. So I just simply focused on her.
In this day in history story, there couldn't have been much detail about who she was or what happened to her.
Well, there was a good amount of detail, but enough to provide a keel, at least for me, to build on. And then I did some other primary source research. I went to the Department of Vital Statistics and got her death certificate, and then found out about different people who were descendants of hers. Found a woman, Georgia Gay, who's a niece of hers, who was still living in Akron. And we met New Year's Day 2000. She had excerpts of Magnolia's mother's diary, and so we did some had some correspondence over the course of a year through that.
What kinds of things did Magnolia's mother write?
Well, she wrote about a lot of the disappointment that not only her daughter experienced, but also that she had to experience through her, you know, just watching her daughter go through this. But the other part of it was just the everydayness of Magnolia's life, how she played, her personality, the fact that she didn't use profanity, and little idiosyncrasies that you wouldn't normally, I wouldn't be able to find out just by reading a newspaper article.
Would you share some words from your book, Magnolia?
Sure. It's probably a good transition to Magnolia's mother's voice. And this is a poem written in Alberta Cox's voice, Magnolia's mom, just watching her daughter jump rope double dutch style with the two ropes. And the poem is simply called Rope. As if two girls were starting a fire on all sides of my daughter, she is set ablaze. The girls swing two clotheslines between them as if they were goddesses holding two country roads leading to each other. Neighbors surround her syncopated dance as her seizure of heat begins to flicker on the moonlit sidewalk. Now the ropes are white hot. Her hair ignites in the upswing. Her barrettes, like petrified butterflies, click on the offbeat. Her knees pump like she's walking on red coals. Her arms flail as if she's calling the rain to put her out. She jumps. She flirts with the flame. She jumps backwards and then turns forward, rocking in and out of the light. Her hands testify around her head or pose on yet-to-be hips, till her fire snuffs out as a wind blows cold, a car with flashing lights slows past, and the braids of our summer night surrender to gravity.
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
And that is the voice and the writing of A. Van Jordan from his collection of poems, Magnolia. It's the winner of a fiction prize for this year's Annisfield Wolf Book Awards, and the award ceremony is this evening at the Cleveland Playhouse. Van, talk about how you arranged your words. Did you have a structure in mind as you began to shape this into a collection?
I had a structure in mind that was simply linear. I just thought I'd start at the beginning of her life and move to the end of her life. There's a very stark contrast between her youth and her adulthood. Magnolia, that ended up dropping out of high school because that event was sort of a turning point for her from innocence to experience. At that point, she sort of realized that doing the right thing and being good isn't always enough, that the world isn't fair. When she got to high school, still a good student, but she didn't have the money for college. This was before Brown versus Board of Education and Affirmative Action. So she just dropped out of high school and became a domestic in the home of a doctor. And, you know, she had an IQ of a genius and wanted to be a doctor. So it was sort of another irony in her life. So what I ended up doing, though, was switching that format and doing a nonlinear reverse chronological order where I start at the end of her life and then move to her moment of greatest potential as a youth.
The book, as I mentioned, is a combination of poetry and prose, mostly poetry. But had you written other works that tell a real story in poetic terms? And I guess it's sort of a combination question. Do you see all of your poetry as telling a real story?
I like dealing with historical figures. I've done that in the past. I initially thought of writing this book as one long epic poem, but as I got into wrestling with all the different voices, I realized that, one, I didn't have the chops for it, and two, that I needed to give each voice its own structure, its own individual tone. And so that's really how the shape of the book came about.
What happened once Magnolia came home? I mean, she lost the national spelling bee, but there was a reception that was positive. When she came back.
Yeah. She placed fifth in the nation because when the first go around, the last round, they pulled the word out, so she was done. But she was still at that point fifth. So when she came back, a big part of the wave of sympathy that built up in Akron came from the reportage from the Beacon Journal. Mabel Norris, this real maverick of a journalist, was chronicling all the discrimination that Magnolia was facing along the way, getting off the train, put in the colored car, not being able to stay at the hotel with the other district champs, not being able to take the stairs, the elevator with the other district champs, climbing the back stairs. She was sequestered off across the room on a card table by herself while the other district champs sat on a dais. So she there are all these articles about what she was dealing with in D.C. So by the time she got back to Akron, they decided to still throw this parade for her because she just still placed.
Right. Yeah, and that's interesting. It seems like the innocence, the loss of it, came not just in the loss of the spelling bee, but mm-hmm. in what she experienced along the way.
Yeah. I mean, it was really a sobering experience, but also an experience that she grew up a bit through.
Mm. What has it meant to you to receive the Annisfield Wolf Book Award for this book?
Well, it's an honor, which is an understatement, but in this time, I think, of our country, I think it's great to have an award that is honoring work that deals with diversity and working through racism. You know, I always think of poetry as being a vehicle to bridge the gaps that we have when we're trying to cross racial lines and gender lines and other lines in this country. And it's good to know that it's being heard.
Van, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been A. Van Jordan, the author of Macnolia, a book of poetry and prose that shares the fiction prize for this year's Anisfield Wolf Book Awards. Those awards, which are administered by the Cleveland Foundation, will be presented tonight at the Cleveland Playhouse in a ceremony that marks the award's 70th anniversary. Up next, you'll meet A. Van Jordan's co-winner of the fiction prize, Edwidge Dantica, and hear some of the words that captured the Anisfield Wolf Selection Committee's attention as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3. Welcome back. You are tuned to a special edition of Around Noon as we bring you arts and culture during the break of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings, which will reconvene at 1:45 p.m. Right now, though, we're introducing you to the winners of this year's Anisfield Wolf Book Awards. And our next award winner is Edwidge Dantica, who tackles hard questions about truth, deception, responsibility, and the narrative of a native of Haiti who is still living in the grip of the past while in America. Edwidge joined me in the Around Noon studios this morning to talk about her Anisfield Wolf award-winning book, The Dewbreaker, and she began by sharing the experience of growing up in Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Well, I was born in Port-au-Prince around 1969, and this was still the dictatorship of the time of François Duvalier, who was commonly called here Papa Doc. And he had come to power in 1957. So in 1969, it was the dictatorship was becoming really entrenched, and it seemed as though François Duvalier, Papa Doc, was going to be president for life. He had declared that, and had declared his son was going to take over for him, which happened. And what it was like to be a child there was that you were very watchful of the dictatorship. People, you know, were trained very early. There were certain things you didn't say because you didn't know really who was loyal to the dictatorship, who might betray you. And there were henchmen of the dictatorship. There was a military state. There were certain, it was a very brutal regime. And there, in some level, you are protected from it being young, but you're not, because you also have to be raised to not to put people's lives in danger, not to misstep.
And those were the things that your parents and family members would teach you as a matter of course. You learn how to walk, you learn how to talk, and you learn how to be careful.
Absolutely. I have a friend who's just a little bit older than me, and she had an experience where, you know, she was 5 years old, and the military came to her family house, you know, looking for her uncle, and she almost made the fatal mistake of saying, you know, they asked about her uncle and she was about to tell the truth, and just, you know, being a child nearly put everybody's life in danger. So you were aware of examples and things like that, and this was part of your education.
When and why did you move to the United States?
Well, my mother and father moved to the United States first. Is a somewhat typical migration pattern from the Caribbean. You know, one or two parents come first, and then they send either for each other or for the children. So my father came, moved to New York in 1971. Then my mother followed 2 years later. They left us with an aunt and uncle who basically raised us. And because of immigration red tape, we couldn't come. My brother and I, who were in Haiti until 1981, when I was 12 and he was 10. So we moved and we came to join them in New York.
What were your impressions of New York when you arrived?
Well, it was it was like time travel, you know. It wasn't so much like now, where I think wherever you are in the world these days, you get a sense a little bit of what other places are like, especially if you have parents there. You know, you were able to go on the internet and things like that. But at that time, that wasn't possible. It was more, you know, there was a New York of the imagination, you know, what the impression that people had is that, you know, there was money on the street and life was so easy, you know, literally the land of milk and honey. So we had this, I had this sort of illusion that my parents were in this, you know, fantastic place. And it was in some ways, you know, so different than what we knew, that it was, you know, like a fantasy on some level. But also, you know, when we got there, when I arrived in Brooklyn, my parents were living in, you know, modestly. And I remember my first impression was that, you know, those buildings, they were in this six-story buildings, and everybody's door was closed all the time. They didn't know their neighbors. That seemed to me a very strange way to live. I remember thinking that, oh, it's like a prison, because also they kept enforcing that once you're in, you know, you have to peek through this hole to see who's coming. And having come from a situation where just life was just lived in the open and everybody knew you, your neighbors, you'd known them for years, it was just a really strange adjustment.
Hmm. Was it hard to lose? Have you ever that feeling of looking over your shoulder or being careful of what you say and do?
Well, it's, each place had its ups and downs. And in New York, you didn't lose it. And I noticed that my parents didn't lose it because the impression and part the reality, too, was that, you know, the dictatorship has really long arms. And even though you were in New York, you were still, you know, my parents were living in a Haitian community, and we still had family back in Haiti. So you had to be still mindful. For example, when I started writing, it was a great cause of concern for my parents, because they said, well, you know, what you say, you know, with such people, they had spent most of their lives in the dictatorship. So for them, the idea of expressing certain things publicly was just seemed dangerous. So we never really lost that too much. I think until 1986, when the dictatorship ended, you know, we never lost those particular worries.
When did writing begin to be a part of the fiber of your being, who you were?
Well, I think, you know, I always say that my first writing teachers were the storytellers in my family, you know, my grandmothers and my aunts who told stories. And the structure of the stories, of listening, of being an audience, I wanted to do that, but I was rather shy. And when I started reading, I said, well, this is another way of telling a story, that you can write something. And I started reading very early and just loved it immediately, as much as I loved, you know, hearing stories. So I started thinking that I wanted to write. I would say my first recollection is when I was about 9 years old. I consciously, while reading something, decided, oh, this would be something great to do. And in some way, whether it's I do it full time, or do I do it, however I do it, I felt like that was something that was going to be a great part of my life.
Tell me something of the story of the Dewbreaker, just an outline of who we're going to meet in the book.
Well, the Dewbreaker is a literal translation of a Creole, a Haitian Creole expression called Chouquet Laouze. And a Chouquet Laouze, or Dewbreaker, is someone who is given by the dictatorship the power to be judge, you know, executioner, just like a henchman of the dictatorship. And they were called Dewbreakers because often they would come in the morning at dawn, when the dew was still on the leaves. So it was almost like the dew stompers, you know, they would come at night, you know, to take people out of their homes. And there was, people were tortured, you know, thousands of people were killed by Dewbreakers. And there were also, you know, high level ones and low level ones. And the man we meet in the story is a man who was a sort of in between. You know, he wasn't the most powerful person in the organization, nor the least powerful. And he was, after having an incident that transforms him, after killing someone who later becomes, you know, sort of a shadow in his life, he decides to move to New York to reform himself. And in the book, we first meet him through the eyes of his daughter, who is a sculptor, who's an artist, and they're getting acquainted on a journey. So we see him through her eyes first, then we see him through the eyes of his wife and several of his victims, and finally we get the story, you know, through his eyes.
Would you share some of the words from your book?
Yes, this is from, the book is in 9 different sections, and this is from the first section called The Book of the Dead, and it's in the voice of the daughter. And she and her father have just begun this journey, and all of a sudden, while they're in a hotel room in Lakeland, Florida, he disappears. My father is gone. I'm slouched in a cast aluminum chair across from two men. One, the manager of the hotel where we're staying, and the other a policeman. They're both waiting for me to explain what's become of him, my father. The hotel manager, Mr. Flavio Salinas, the plaque on his office door reads, has the most striking pair of chartreuse eyes I've ever seen on a man with an island Spanish lilt to his voice. The police officer, Officer Beau, is a baby-faced, short, white Floridian with a pot belly. Where are you and your daddy from, Ms. Bien-Aimée? Officer Beau asks, doing the best he can with my last name. He and Salinas are the only people in Salinas' office, so at first I think he's talking to someone else. I was born and raised in East Flatbush, Brooklyn, and have never been to my parents' birthplace. Still, I answer, Haiti, because it is more... Still, I answer, Haiti, because it is one more thing I've always longed to have in common with my parents. Officer Beau plows forward with, you all the way down here in Lakeland from Haiti? We live in New York, I say. We are on our way to Tampa. To do what? Officer Beau continues, visit? To deliver a sculpture, I say. I'm an artist, a sculptor. I'm really not an artist, not in the way I'd like to be. I'm more of an obsessive wood carver with a single subject thus far, my father.
Beautiful words, and the words of Edwidge Dantica, the author of The Dewbreaker, a winner of the Fiction Prize for the Annisfield Wolf Book Award, and she will be part of the ceremony that is on tonight at the Cleveland Playhouse. In the meantime, you are tuned to Around Noon on 90.3, and Edwidge joins me in the studio. Edwidge, the Dewbreaker allows us to think about issues such as the lines between love and hate, people who commit terrible acts that one can hate, yet commit their lives to wives, children, family that they love, like any of us. Your thoughts on how those lines cross and blur in your book?
Well, I think the struggle of a lot of exiles, immigrants, is that, you know, you have the ordinary food and water and shelter and the things that you're escaping and coming to new things. But often, you know, there are things that follow us here and that are beyond memories. You know, they're actually sometimes the perpetrators of the crimes that have driven a lot of people to come to the United States follow them also. You know, they live in the same communities sometimes, and people have to redefine their relationship with these people because they can become, you know, your grocer, your barber, as in this case. And so in the book, this family is wrestling with that. And even, you know, the father, who was a torturer in the 60s and made his life here, finds that even he encounters later torturers, you know, other mass murderers who have come over. And there's this personal example for me. I was living in New Rochelle, New York, when I was writing this book, and not but a few miles away, there was a man living there who had been one of the massacres of the Rwandan genocide, you know, who was living in Scarsdale, New York. And you have cases now where people are suing these, you know, the victims are suing these people here for retribution for crimes committed back in, you know, in their country. So it's dealing with that, you know, it's a whole mixture of emotions, mm-hmm. and also how much, you know, when one of these people claim that they're reformed, how much do we, how much do we believe it? How much should we forgive them? And what is it like from the perspective of one of their own family members? Because, you know, it's not every monster is a monster to everybody. So, you know, there's a family there as well. And so the book is asking, you know, is asking these questions through the experience of this family. You know, is redemption possible? And at when can we forgive and when can we accept love and hate? And you know, human emotion is not a simple thing. And that's why we have so much material for literature and art and the complexity and the messiness of those emotions.
Mm. What does it mean to you to be able to tell the stories of Haiti, of people both there and here, and to be part of this prize for that writing?
Well, it's an extraordinary thing, you know, because also given the, you know, the history of those who have won this prize, you know, you think of, I think of other African-Americans who've won it, who are connected to Haiti in some way, like Langston Hughes, who traveled to Haiti in the 40s, who was a good friend with one of our greatest novelists, Jacques Roumain, who actually translated Jacques Roumain's Master of the Dew with Mercer Cook, and you know Zora Neale Hurston, who has written extensively about Haiti and her anthropological writing, and who, by some accounts, wrote "There I Was Watching God" while she was in Haiti. So it's an extraordinary honor to be part of that line. You know, it's in some ways to enter what is an amazing circle.
The voice of Edwidge Dantaka, author of The Dewbreaker, who will be honored tonight as part of the Annisfield Wolf Book Award 70th Anniversary Ceremony. She visited us today around noon. And we thank you for listening to our special program. Our technical producer was Jeff Carlton. Executive producer, Mark Rosenberger. Around Noon is produced by Dave DiOrio. And we resume at 1:45 our gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings on the nomination of John Roberts for Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Good afternoon.